Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way? Welcome back to the Henson Perspective. I'm Ben.
I'm Pete.
And you join us once again as we discuss the 45th anniversary of the original New York air date of an episode of The Muppet Show. This week, we're going to be discussing the episode featuring Kay Ballard, which originally aired on March 7th, 1977, after having been filmed from November 23rd to 26th of 1976, the 23rd out of 24 production episodes, nearly closing out the first season.
Even though we have four after this still?
A good chunk of miscellaneous episodes to come.
Three after this.
Yes, there will be one episode 2 weeks after this, and then a three-week gap before they drop the last two episodes, which apparently they're ashamed of? Who knows? I'm surprised that one of them was left so much in the apparent schedule doghouse. The other one, having watched it, not so much.
I think also, I know which episode you're talking about because I believe I have also watched that episode.
And none of this is to say that that narrative of we waited for as long as possible and then sort of shuffled them out under our under the cover of night is accurate. It could have been something going on with CBS. There could have been a special event or a miniseries.
I don't actually something.
I don't actually know the answer to that question. Maybe we'll figure it out during those gap weeks.
Could be. Could be. I'm going to guess out of the two of us, it will be you who figures this out if either of us does.
So that being said, we will talk about Kay Ballard and her contributions to the show in the second third of the episode. But first, we're going to wander through the other segments of the show that didn't involve her. And then we will come back to her contributions and then wrap up the episode by talking about statistics that have accrued and our favorite moments from the show.
So the episode starts off, the episode does start off with this. Was it my transfer? I don't know, Disney Plus something. This spotlight on Kermit seemed a lot brighter.
I agree. It was noticeably white around the ring of the O.
Okay, cool. Not just me then.
No.
Otherwise, nothing special about Kermit's introduction, but I just saw that and was like, huh, that seems different. Then Fozzie tells a joke about Miss Piggy that she does not like, and she hi-yahs him for our very first hit. That might be the fastest we've gotten a hit so far in the show.
What is different about Kermit is in his next bit, where he comes on after Fozzie's joke and Piggy's hit. Actually, before we get past that, Fozzie and Piggy, of course, are traditionally voiced by the same person. Who plays Piggy in the opening?
I don't think it is mentioned in the notes or
in the cast list at the bottom of the fandom entry. Normally, of course, substitute Piggy is Richard Hunt. I suspect it's Aaron Oscar.
Yeah, it is. There are not two Miss Piggies listed in the credits by.
Because it didn't sound like Richard Hunt's normal voice, and it did sound mildly feminine.
Hey, have you heard the one about this very fat pig?
Have you heard the one about this very flat bear?
So I suspect it was Aaron, which is a strange piece of substitution, and one that I'm sort of surprised it took them this long to figure out.
I mean, they may have just been thinking, yeah, men do this voice, men can continue to do this voice.
Kermit then, in introducing Kay Ballard, makes a nervous face, does a squinchy down on the corners of his mouth, as if he's nervous to say her name, which was not the normal level of excitement we get from Kermit when introducing a star. And also felt like potentially they were setting it up for a runner, which never materialized.
Which also is a, quote, running theme throughout this episode.
Of runners that start and then don't go someplace?
Yes.
Mm. I agree.
And then Crazy Harry blows something up before Gonzo can hit the gong, which we saw in episode 118. So we've seen that one before. Still counted it as an explosion because we've determined that the repeated different episodes count.
It was originally in the Phyllis Diller episode, and in the start of that episode, I asked you, hey, it seemed like Gonzo was saying something, and you were like, no, I didn't really notice. He definitely says it here.
Yes.
I went back and checked the Phyllis Diller episode. They changed the audio mix so that the audience laughter drowns out Gonzo.
Hmm.
Thank you!
And so it's very deliberately done to cover up what he says here, which is...
Not bad.
I also clocked that this intro was 2 seconds longer than the usual intros are, but the music still stopped at a minute and 18 seconds. So the song ends, Gonzo says, not bad.
And they have a moment to react to that.
Yeah. So that was interesting. And yeah, I don't think the Phyllis Diller episode did that.
No.
Then we have the opening when Kermit comes in to introduce, and as he runs on stage, he falls or trips, or...
He definitely slips and falls, but his fall is to the noise of a snare drum and a cymbal.
Yeah.
And so, is he falling into the orchestra pit and getting tangled up in the drum set? Or is that just what they thought was the comedy sound of falling?
Yeah, I have no idea.
But as he falls a couple more times in the episode, it's always to the sound of drums.
Mm-hmm. And never resolved.
It happens twice. Happens in this, and it happens as he introduces a number for Kay Ballard. And then,
but in the second one, he falls twice.
Correct. So it seems clear that there's going to be an escalation.
Right now, gang, it's time to meet a star who knows her way around a song like I know my way around a lily pad, Miss Kay Ballard.
Which then never materializes.
Yeah, because he introduces Kay Ballard one more time later, never falls.
Doesn't fall backstage, it doesn't carry on to any other part of the show.
Nope. I hated it. I mean, I liked it. I liked him falling, but I didn't like...
The fact that they didn't give you why.
Or address it at all. Mm. It was just Kermit's falling this week. But then he introduces the first act, which is a song by the Country Trio, In the Summertime. Now, Ben.
Pete?
I typically don't enjoy... straight musical performances.
But this isn't a straight musical performance. Because during the instrumental bridges between the verses, the characters vocally emote the instrumentation that they're playing. And so you get a verse of a song that's not particularly funny.
In the summertime when all the trees and leaves are green and a red bird sings out of the blue, 'cause you don't want my love.
The song is called You Don't Want My Love by Roger Miller, who is a country western singer who shows up later in the show as a guest. I believe he's in season 3. I believe he's in season 2. I'm going to edit that accordingly. But the lyrics aren't especially hilarious. So really the joy and the humor from this piece comes from the fact that they've decided to perform in that strange way where they're doing the voices while they're playing the instruments. So during the bits that you would hate, which is just, hey, we're flailing around at these instruments, they're doing these very physical performances while also vocalizing the notes that they're playing. And I found it hilarious.
It's great. Hey, Ben, it's great. Didn't hate this one bit. I only have one complaint, which is... I feel like the wrong upright bass hand was anchored to the instrument. The hand on the neck should have been the one to be able to move.
In order to get different fingerings.
Yep. And because that's the thing that you enjoy watching about an upright bass.
Is you enjoy him walking up and down the neck.
Where if the other hand was just on the strings that's doing this, you could have just anchored that and like... wobbled the puppet around to make that arm flop around, and it would have seemed like it was there, and then you could have articulated the neck.
It's a good note, and considering that inaccurate instrumentation is the bane of your existence, these performances.
It truly is.
I get that's why it's your note.
But it's my only note, because I otherwise, like I said, very much enjoyed this.
really, the vocal performance during the bridges is what makes this as a sketch, because otherwise, it's pretty ordinary, and it doesn't have a lot of comic game to it until that suddenly shows up.
But even when they're not doing that, they're still bouncing around, mm-hmm. and I don't know if it's because they're human Muppets, mm. or instead of Muppets, that I am willing to give them more leeway?
I think you would have enjoyed this as much if it were the Jug Band.
Yes.
Who are less human Muppets.
Mm-hmm.
I think you wouldn't have enjoyed this if it was the Electric Mayhem.
Yeah.
Even if they were doing this exact stuff.
I am inclined to agree with you. Well, we weren't the only two who enjoyed this sketch, Ben.
Yes.
Because after this is finished, we go to Statler and Waldorf, where they call for an encore, and then they do a joke they've also done before.
We get to our first backstage bit, and this is an interaction between Floyd, as played by Jerry Nelson, and Kermit, as played by Jim Henson.
This is a very Jerry Nelson-heavy episode.
Mm-hmm. But we get a fair amount of Aaron Oscar. We get a decent amount of John Lovelady, but almost no Dave Goals in this episode. And whereas this backstage part has been Piggy, it's been Fozzie, it's been Gonzo, therefore it's been Frank and it's been Dave a lot. And it's even been Scooter on occasion. But we get very little Dave and very little Richard Hunt in this episode.
Richard Hunt is only Statler, and Dave Goals is only Zoot and the Barber.
Mm.
We'll talk about later.
Zoot gets a line?
I think...
in this first crowd scene.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's also in at the dance.
Mm.
And
good point.
I think he's also in another background.
Oh, yes. Spot. And to be fair, obviously, I assume the puppeteers are performing the puppets even when they don't have lines. And so they're filling out the cast.
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting that their voices are so underutilized in this episode.
Yeah, it is mostly Jim, Frank, and Jerry this episode.
We get a lengthy moment of Floyd coming up to Kermit because he does a circumlocutory walk to get around to then tap him on the wrong shoulder and have Kermit turn around the wrong way. We haven't seen that walk since the original pilot.
Okay, so we have seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I wasn't sure if we'd seen it before or whether this was just a real odd choice that they decided to put in episode 23. Or maybe we haven't seen Floyd except for when he's behind a guitar.
We haven't seen it in a long time. It's in the Sex and Violence pilot, specifically because while he's Floyd Pepper, which is probably a mashup of Sergeant Pepper and Pink Floyd, the Pink Floyd is the part I'm not sure about. The Sergeant Pepper, it obviously is, based on his normal jacket that he wears when he's not in his pit musician suit that he wears throughout the course of this episode. In Sex and Violence, there's a moment where he says, well, we got to keep on trucking, and that's how he walks off stage. And it's a deliberate homage to Robert Crumb's cartoons.
Okay.
So that's a very strange mashup. Pink Floyd, the Beatles, and Robert Crumb doesn't really work. So it's a callback to something that really doesn't continue as part of his character. And I would be very surprised if it ever shows up again.
Well, maybe I'll remember to keep an eye out for it. It's so visually striking that if it does happen again, I will notice it.
Absolutely.
If it doesn't happen again, probably won't.
Floyd comes in to say that he's quitting because he's sick of playing the Muppet Show theme. And so the runner for the backstage bits of the show will be Floyd and Kermit tussling over how much he hates the theme because it's not hip. And he, as an artist and musician, feels like he needs to be true to his avant-garde musical self. And Kermit trying to get him to continue to perform because he's also dragging the rest of the band with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kermit eventually convinces Floyd he can't quit before Kay Ballard's big number. So they agree to stay on through that. I really enjoyed when Floyd was trying to convince Kermit how lame the song was. And then Kermit starts dancing to it.
Dun 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 dun.
Nice. Really enjoying the extra lame version of the song.
Which isn't in and of itself a little bit of a runner. We'll get people jamming out to the theme at least one more time in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the general conceit of somebody saying, if Floyd is so weird, he really wouldn't put up with this. Mm-hmm. And that he then convinces the rest of the Electric Mayhem to bail with him is interesting. Hey, Pete.
Yeah.
Do we see Janice in the crowd with everybody else?
In this part?
We see Dr. Teeth, who's very minor and in the background because Kermit is in front, and therefore Henson can't play both roles. Mm-hmm. We've got Aaron Oscar playing the female trumpeter, who gets replaced by a totally different character in future seasons. We've got Zoot with his very brief line by Dave Goals, and we have Animal.
We see her at the dance,
but she's not in the band.
Right, because instead Trumpet Girl is.
But isn't that interesting that Janice is part of the Electric Mayhem, but she doesn't seem to be part of the pit band?
But is she normally? In the opening credits, do we see Janice?
I think she's one of the dancers who comes out yes, with...
correct.
It's time to play the music.
Yes, so she is not quitting. Because she's not singing the song. One other piece of inconsistencies. Crazy Harry is technically a part of the pit band.
Yes, he is.
Because we never see Rolf. Mm-hmm. Rolf is not part of this, and we'll get into that later. Mm-hmm. But at that very end, it should have been a piano and a triangle. Kermit then introduces Kay Ballard, mm-hmm. falls down again, mm-hmm. says his intro for Kay, and then as he leaves, falls down one more time. The last time we'll see him fall down this episode. Again, I like it. I hate it.
Kay Ballard's number we will come back to, after which Statler and Waldorf talk a little bit about Kay before we get the second of the four backstage segments.
I do want to mention that in the Statler and Waldorf section, Statler effectively Me Too's himself.
And watch Kay Ballard all night.
I tried it once, but she pulled the shade down.
You dirty old man.
And Waldorf smacks him for it.
Yep. A hit was happened, so we did have to mention that.
In the backstage segment, we get the second segment of Floyd's complaint, because having now performed for Kay Ballard...
Okay, green stuff, me and the guys stayed through the Kay Ballard number, and now before it's time for that awful theme song, we're leaving.
Kermit says, look, if you can stick around and play the end number just one more time, we're then going to have somebody rewrite it. And so it will be different next time. I promise you it will be better. But we just need it one more time. And the game of this is the whole group leaving, then coming back, then leaving, then coming back.
And it's eventually revealed that Nigel will be the one to rewrite the episode, and they can't take that because he's the square who wrote the first one.
Nigel, in the Sex and Violence pilot, where he was effectively the focus host character, mm-hmm. was voiced by Jim Henson. Here he's not. Here he's John Lovelady. And so it's a very different take on his voice. In Sex and Violence, he was basically the mostly unaltered Jim Henson. Maybe a little nasally, more nasal than Jim normally is, but in general, it was a fairly unaffected voice, and Lovelady's just doing a totally different voice for Nigel. I think it's what voice most of us would do if we were told, do a character named Nigel.
I always thought it was kind of a hip tune.
Yeah, it would either be this or have a slight British lilt. Mm-hmm. After this, we have a Muppet Newsflash featuring our guest star, so we'll come back to that. And then we go to the dance. And Ben, George is so pogo.
I'm not sure that this counts as pogoing so much as this counts as having a seizure on the dance floor.
Having a vertical seizure.
And the camera highlights it. This is the first thing we see, basically, is George
jackhammering.
Vibrating across the floor.
He's using the speed force.
This is where, as you say, we get Dave Goals doing his very brief vocal performance in the show as he performs Zoot. Because Zoot and Janice are dancing together and talking about their families.
My family has quite a history. You can find a record of them in the 17th century.
Ah, so is my family. You can find a record of them in the 19th precinct.
Doesn't work, but I still like it.
It is funny how much it doesn't work.
Uh-huh.
Structurally, it's fine.
Yeah.
Except for logically, it's not.
Yeah. Yeah, which is why it works perfectly as the first joke in the At the Dance, because it's like, and then you get something else right there after it, so you don't have time to think about it. This definitely should not have been the last joke, because then you would have been like, you would have gone to break being like, is that 19th precinct? What's going on there? Next up, we have the return of Pogo George and Mildred, where Mildred asks him why his humor is so crass or something along those lines.
Basically says, George, every time we talk, our conversation inevitably goes into the gutter. To which George says, that's because I'm trying to get you to relate to it.
He's basically saying that he's actually above Mildred.
Mm-hmm.
That he comes down to her level.
Which is some hardcore negging.
Yeah.
I mean, not what I think its intent is. I think it's just...
It's supposed to be subvert our expectations.
Uh-huh.
He's a janitor, she's a fancy lady, but in fact, he's smarter than her or something. He's the original Good Will Hunting.
But, and again, it's one of those jokes that it sets up a comic reversal, but boy, are we glad we're moving past it, because it doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
Mm-hmm. Then we have the return of our favorite loud lady.
And she is in the middle of an anecdote where something terrible has happened because she's saying,
what kind of a girl do you think I am? I told him I never wanted to see him again. Never, never, never. Do you think I did the right thing, Herman?
But what she really wants to know is from the guy whose name we get for the first time. His name is Herman.
Yep.
Which is perfect.
Yeah.
He definitely comes across as a Herman.
And he's her man.
Oh, yes. Well, except he's her second man.
Yeah. Yeah, because the other one's head got blown off or something.
After they got engaged, he disappeared.
Right. Yeah.
She's here to ask Herman, did she do the right thing?
And he reveals he was not listening to her at all.
Perfect joke.
Yep.
But character-based. Would this have worked if we hadn't have had 6 Loud Lady jokes prior to this?
No. The only way this same joke would have worked was if Loud Lady was with Statler or Waldorf.
Mm.
And then they could have said, I
had my hearing aid turned down.
Yeah, or something like that.
And we end with the first appearance of Kermit and Piggy as a dance couple in At the Dance. Right. And Piggy is speaking limited Italian to Kermit. She says, il canto e l'amore mi bambino, which I don't speak Italian, but I'm pretty sure that means with song and love my baby.
Close enough to what I got from my limited Spanish knowledge.
We've talked before about Piggy's command of romantic languages, because we've talked about her not knowing French in the Charles Aznavour episode, whether or not she did know Spanish and French prior to that, and now here, the cosmopolitan pig, who's probably appeared on the cover of Cosmo at some point in her career,
mm-hmm.
Is now speaking, but what's the joke? She's not speaking Italian.
No, Kermit asks her if she is, and she says no, she's speaking pig Latin. And she starts laughing, and the other two pigs dancing in the background uproariously laughing as well.
Did you time how long the laugh is?
I did not.
It's basically, however, the length of the fifth joke in At the Dance. Frank just lets loose.
Yep. Yeah, Frank just franks.
It fades to black, as it often does for At the Dance, and we come back from commercial to the UK spot, where we have Jerry Nelson playing the old grandpa from the jug band, sitting in front of a cabin, doing a song called Life Gets Tejious, Don't It?
Mm-hmm.
Song, well, it is a song, but he doesn't really sing it.
Yeah, it's...
chanted.
Talk sung.
Sprechsinger.
Sure. Is that pig Latin?
Basically, the premise of the song is most of the things that we do are things that we do over and over again, and therefore, if you really think about it, they're kind of depressing and samey.
This is an elaborate set for a UK spot as well.
Mm.
We're used to just a different coloring of lights behind a background to give it something, and a piano, and that's it. But this set, it's elaborate and it's
interactive. Has a special effect. So. Because in the last verse of the song, as he says, sometimes you stand up and then the house falls down. And so you get the roof and the timbers and everything falls down around the grandpa.
Yep.
This, while the lyrics are supposed to be comic, lies flat on the screen.
Yeah, but I still liked it.
Interesting.
Yeah. I have a note that says, simultaneously nothing happens and is very visually interesting.
There was a lot of business.
Yeah, and even though it was mostly just Pa rocking back and forth while speak-singing, like, they cut to hands on the clock circling, the dog howling, the rat does some stuff. things happen while nothing happens.
They've come up with ways of having animation and background action in order to do something about a song that's basically about nothing happening.
Mm-hmm.
So they found a bunch of small comic devices to do it. I found none of them actually funny.
No, I didn't think it was funny at all. Except maybe the house falling down.
But no, I found myself concentrating on the costume of the character and thinking, oh, you can buy clothes for small boys and then you can put Muppets in them. You just need to get a pair of jeans from a department store and then weather it up like it's been on a crusty old man. Huh. The fact that I was concentrating on the behind-the-scenes process that would have led to making that Muppet showed you how uninvested I was in this actual sketch.
Well, turnabout is fair play, I guess, because I'm all on board for this.
Your unpredictability is astonishing.
Mm-hmm. After that, we have the talk spot with Kate Ballard, so we'll return to that. Then we have the other quote-unquote runner of the episode. We have a barbershop sketch where a rocker with long green hair enters a barbershop and wants the barber to cut it short.
How do you connect this to a runner?
Because Statler and Waldorf refer to it as a runner.
Yeah, I have the feeling this is a running gag.
Yes, but it's the audience that should be doing the running.
That's right.
And then it cuts back. The barber is still cutting, but the rocker is a little bit smaller. And then it cuts back to Statler and Waldorf, where Waldorf makes fun of Statler's haircut. Then it cuts back, and the barber is finally done, and all that's left is a little green ball, which he then sneezes and blows the rocker away.
So, the way you're talking about this, as an aborted runner, did you think that they had initially planned on having this happen two or three times, where they're always cutting back to this?
I didn't until they cut in and said this is a running gag, which made me think, oh, it would have been better as a running gag.
Okay.
Where, again, 45 years, we can make anything better.
I would be interested to see your own... I mean, if you wanted to be Topher Grace and recut this episode so that it had that as an actual runner behind the scenes, you could then prove whether or not this was functional. It would just take you about 15 minutes with Apple iMovie to redistribute these scenes throughout the episode and then see if you'll actually laugh more.
Well, no, because it would need a little bit more framing.
Mm.
So the solution I came up with is if towards the beginning of the episode, because my other issue with this is that the barber himself says this is going to take a while.
Yes.
And in turn, it takes 45 seconds.
Mm.
So you can't
have
it both
ways. Yeah, the
middle
segment is basically the ball of green saying, you're really taking your time with this.
Yeah. So if you introduced the barber early on as he wants to give audience members haircuts, and then this guy came on, and he goes, oh, this is going to take a while. And then halfway through the episode, we come back, and he hasn't really made that big of a dent. And then at the end of the episode, we get the reveal of
the tiny, tiny ball of fuzz.
Yeah. Now makes total sense why it took all episode for him to get one customer done.
So you're saying it would have actually needed to have been slightly rewritten?
Yes, because you would have needed the framing device of why this man is giving a haircut during the length of a variety show.
Mm. Whereas, as it is presented to us, especially with Statler and Waldorf watching it, it isn't a thing that's happening during the Muppet Show to a Muppet. It's clearly a sketch.
Yeah, I suppose so. But it isn't because it is the same Muppet all three times. So it's not like they were swapping out costumes or something like that.
But it's supposed to be an ellipsed time. That's what the cuts to the box are, is a way of creating a sense that more time has happened than we actually see through the television.
Mm, this is where I'm on your side.
That we only see what's real.
Yeah. That they are cutting away so that way they can do these different things.
But for the length of the Statler box is the length of what's happening on stage.
Yes. In this case, yes.
All I'm saying is I think we might need a few more years to fix this. 45 might not quite have been enough.
Well, I'm not saying I can actually fix it. But I wrote a better version of it.
45 years, we can punch anything up slightly.
Exactly.
Understood. From the Barber sketch, we then get Floyd saying they've decided to stay, but with conditions. If, he says, if you allow me to write the new theme. And all of this feels like it's escalating towards a comeuppance for Floyd. That, as he says, he's so avant-garde that if he didn't know he was a genius, even he wouldn't like his music. And I therefore assumed that this was escalation towards when they finally perform the theme, the rest of the band hates it. Seems like the logical comedic endpoint, that he then goes so far afield that he alienates everybody else that also is playing it. They're like, we don't want to have to play this from week to week.
Yeah, no, because if that were true, then he wouldn't be in the band. Assuming that he writes some of the songs, then if the rest of the band members didn't like what he did, he wouldn't be a member.
Yeah, you say that. I think a little bit about George Harrison, who wrote very, very few numbers because his stuff was not really in keeping with the tone. And I don't want to say they were like, okay, George, it's fine, because I haven't watched all 72 hours of the Beatles documentary and I don't know all of the dynamics. But through cultural osmosis, I have always gotten the feeling that George's sitar-based spiritual numbers were more done out of a sense of loyalty than an actual belief that they were going to be hits that the Beatles could all get behind.
True. I guess we don't know who the main songwriter of
The Electric Mayhem is.
Yeah, whether it's Dr. Teeth or whether it's a group effort or what.
Because it's Dr. Teeth and The Electric Mayhem, I have always assumed that he was the lead personality.
The thing that struck with me is Floyd is to music what David Lynch is to film.
Continue.
Because David Lynch said that he didn't understand what Mulholland Drive was about until the third time he watched Mulholland Drive, when he wrote and directed Mulholland Drive. So yeah, if Floyd also wouldn't like his own music unless he knew that he was a genius.
Nobody understands my music. I mean, I don't even understand it.
You don't?
If I didn't know I was a genius, I wouldn't listen to the trash I write.
It made me laugh just because of that fact.
Anyway, it ends with Kermit being a little bit scared after initially being excited that he's going to get some fun, hip, original composition from Floyd Pepper, certified genius. He then leaves by saying, gee, I can hardly wait to hear this since you've told me I'm going to hate it.
Mm-hmm.
Where we then cut to the second Vendaface sketch.
Yeah.
When I talked about Vendaface last time, I said, Vendaface should be a sketch about people getting their face replaced. And this time, the Vendaface introduces itself not as a counseling machine, but as the first fully automatic facelift machine.
Yeah. This should have happened first.
Mm-hmm.
The psychiatric one still doesn't make any sense. Even with this one coming first.
You could have punched that up easily. With the vending machine, after it fails, after somebody gets complaints, it then has a paper sign hanging on it that says something else. You know, it's trying to rebrand itself.
Mm-hmm. But no, we still got that one first. This one second.
But we at least finally get the premise actually explored in this sketch. I found this sketch interestingly laborious because Jerry Nelson's doing a very funny bit, which is that he is vocalizing all of the sound effects of the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever the hands do anything, Nelson's going, pop, and I think they thought that was hilarious.
Now for phase one.
However, this sketch goes from 18 minutes and 5 seconds to 20 minutes and 30 seconds. The first phase one takes 25 seconds to remove all of the pieces. It then takes an additional 25 seconds to put it back on. They were at least aware of the fact that they were burning daylight. And so during the second person where Aaron Oscar comes in, sees how Frank Oz's character has been transformed, says, oh, I love it, and puts her own coin in the slot. She then only takes 14 seconds to have her face taken off, and an additional 14 seconds to have it. So they knew they needed to do it slightly more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still took forever for something that we knew was going to happen. And his sound effects were not funny enough to sustain a very obvious punchline we could all see coming, except for her, because her eyes were in a box.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like if that happened to you, wouldn't you just buy your face back? So I would have liked the end of this sketch to have been her not having money, or like reaching in her pocket to buy it back and being like, oh, I don't have the 5 cents, and then like hitting the machine as it faded to black or something, instead of just running off.
Great punch up.
45 years. I didn't hate this.
I didn't hate it, but boy.
I certainly liked it more than the first one.
I certainly liked it more the first time.
Okay, yeah. Sure.
And then the third time I watched it, in order to time it, was an act of pure masochism.
I did have a similar wondering about the jeans moment that you did during the UK spot. Wondering how the drawer was aligned to, okay, I put the ones I'm taking off in the front half, and then the pieces that I'm putting on are in the back half. So I also did drift off and think about, how was this produced?
I'll give you a quick piece of total speculation. I would have had another Muppeteer handing the pieces up so that you knew you were going to get the right ones.
Yeah, fair. Yeah. That's probably 100% how it was done. Not a drawer. Although that could explain the 28 seconds if he was fishing around. You're like, oh no, I don't. Okay, there it is.
After Vendaface, we get the backstage that we've all been waiting for, where they're debuting, that's not a word.
Nope.
Where they're debuting the new theme.
Called Fugue for Frog.
Kermit says, I love it based on the title, and Floyd says, good, because you're going to hate the rest of it.
Hit it!
So, Ben, did you like or hate the song?
I thought the finale was great, because after some initial jazziness, it then turns into discordant notes that aren't very pleasing. But then they all chant simultaneously, Mup, 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 Et, Show! And then they end with a very similar chord to the trumpet that is played by Gonzo at the end.
I thought it was Muppet Show.
Could have been. What did the subtitles say?
That's actually what the subtitles said.
Ah.
But during the music part, it said, playing uncoordinated jazz.
I think is very fair. I think that's a good attempt at trying to communicate the dissonance that was taking place.
I think it was dissonant, but I don't think it was uncoordinated, because it all went together.
Yeah.
And
it was a little scattered. It didn't have melody in a direction.
It was also written over 2.5 minutes, because that's about how long Vendaface was, right? So I thought that this could be a current late-night talk show theme song.
Mm.
It reminded me very much of, like, a Conan theme song or something like that. But it's too short.
There's the thing that sometimes happens on late-night shows where they do a bit where they're going to make up a new theme right when they play it. It had that quality of, we put this together basically as an improv of a bunch of skilled musicians who were doing something, and then we're going to wave it closed.
So this was only 16 seconds
long. Whereas the actual theme is?
A minute and 18.
Mm. But that includes Fozzie and Kermit.
So it's a minute and 9 seconds without the Fozzie part. So you still need, hold on, I wrote this down. It needs to be 53 more seconds to be as long as the current theme song for the opening. But if they shorten the opening, then I'd like this new version. They'd have to cut out Janice dancing, no Fozzie joke, Gonzo hits the gong, done.
You know, if Floyd had worked on it for a little bit longer, he could have had the Lost theme song.
Mm.
Wow. 6.5 seconds of tone. Kermit is unhappy. Floyd points out that the frog has no musical taste. But they all seem pretty pleased with it.
Yeah, and then Kermit
says, that's great, but how are you going to play that from back here when you need to do the next number with Kay Ballard?
Yeah.
There's a real weird leap of logic there that makes Kermit's dialogue make basically no sense.
Yeah.
Floyd's joke is fine, which is what I think they were leading up to.
And besides that, how are you going to play Kay Ballard's closing number from back here?
Like always, loudly.
I think it's more that he's trying to tell them to get on stage because they need to be on stage for the Kay Ballard number. Like, what are you still doing back here?
Got it. Either way,
unless you're playing that number from back here.
The dialogue doesn't quite work.
No, it's clunky at best.
And let's point out that it's probably not good form to have your band playing loudly in the wings while something is going on stage.
Or maybe nothing.
Either way, it's either ruining an active number or it's teasing the audience with something that's going on that they can't see while the stage is empty.
Yeah.
It's not respectful to somebody.
It's a bad show.
Kermit's a lousy producer. If there's something I've learned over the course of this series, it's that it never should have been renewed. That Scooter's uncle should have 100% kicked him out of the theater and found somebody with some professionalism.
Yeah, but every time we get an audience shot, audience is full, so it's selling tickets.
There are four rows.
Small theater, but it's selling out. If it's selling out, it's selling out.
Sometimes it's selling out because the people who are in the audience are also on stage.
Listen, have I performed sketch shows where 90% of the audience are other sketch performers who are just there to do their stuff and only 10% are actual audience members? Yeah.
Perhaps the best explanation for what's going on in the Muppet audience we've seen so far. We have Kay Ballard's closing number, but the capper for the Floyd bit comes during the final curtain in advance of Kay saying her farewells.
Yeah, so let's not talk about that. Yeah, yet. Let's do...
When we include the Kay Ballard, that'll be our capper for the whole show.
Yeah.
Okay, then let's get to talking about Kay Ballard. But first, I'm going to ask Pete 5 trivia questions based on my research into Kay Ballard. Question number 1. Kay Ballard broke into professional performing somewhere between the age of 16 and 19. She lied about her birth age, and biographies differ as to when she began touring with a burlesque show as a comic actress doing sketches. In her memoir, she recounts a producer doubtfully asking whether she was auditioning as a dancer, something that hadn't even occurred to her. From burlesque to vaudeville, she began performing with Spike Jones in California. As a featured player with the orchestra, her official website points out that she specialized in a key musical instrument that she also plays in her final number on The Muppet Show. Does her website list her as playing A, the clarinet, B, the flute, or C, the tuba?
I picked the two that I thought it might have been. I'm going to say flute.
The New York Times obituary from 2019 lists that she played both the flute and the tuba with the orchestra, but tuba is the only one listed on the front page of the website.
I'm going to count that as another half point.
Stop fiddling with the scores. Question number 2. Kay Ballard was born Catherine Gloria Bellotta and chose Kay Ballad, no E, and Ballad like the song, as her stage name. Which is true of the evolution of her name into K with an E, Ballard, as her performer nom de plume? A. K with an E was added because K Ballard was already a young man working in Hollywood in Bongo Dance Party Beach Pictures in 1954. B. K became Katie Ballard with a Y, and then Katie Ballard with an IE, and then K with an E Ballard as she was shuffled between studios in Hollywood, each one trying to freshen up her persona. Or C. The E and R were added in a newspaper misprint. She went back to it being an E-less K for slightly less than a decade in the 70s based on advice from a numerologist.
Ugh, those are all good options. I'm going to say B.
No, C is the correct answer. Sometime after the 70s, she returned the E to her name and then just gave interviews saying about how silly it was that she followed the advice. Question number three. Ballard was a working performer who was seemingly more interested in the job than the notoriety. In her memoir, entitled How I Lost 10 Pounds in 53 Years, she talks about how there's a chance she's the kind of supporting performer who will leave the public's consciousness after she passes away. Her most prominent credit in her obituaries was a 1967 Desilu sitcom called Mothers-in-Law, where she was co-lead with Eve Arden. Which brush with greatness that could have made her career out of the following three is made up. A. She was the first person to record Fly Me to the Moon in 1954 as a B-side to a song called Lazy Afternoon. The song was originally called In Other Words, before Sinatra, who she calls Frank What's-His-Name in her memoir, recorded it in 1964. B. Ballard performed a review called Kay Ballard Sings Fanny Bryce, starting as a concept in 1954 and an album in 1959, which was totally eclipsed by Streisand's performance of Bryce in Funny Girl on Broadway in 64 and then on film in 68. Or C. She befriended Gypsy Rose Lee in 1961 and worked on developing a one-woman show about her before Jerome Robbins directed Gypsy with lyrics by Sondheim for Ethel Merman in 1963.
C.
Correct. Robbins and Merman's Gypsy started on Broadway in 1959, and Ballard was able to take over the part in local and touring productions after Merman was done with the role. Question number four. Articles about Ballard talk about how she desperately tried to break into film, but she never rose to prominence. Considering her early career in burlesque, this 1976 racy film role with a Muppet Show co-star isn't perhaps surprising, but also definitely helped keep her from reaching the general populace. Only one of these is true. A. She was in The Ritz with Rita Moreno. Ballard plays the wife of the main character, while Moreno is a transsexual bathhouse attendant. B. She was in Scorchy with Connie Stevens, where she plays a women's correctional officer. Or C. She was in Death of a Gunfighter with Lena Horne, playing a Western brothel madam. All of the films are real. Her appearance in it, only one of them is real.
Only I actually looked up Scorchy. I'm going with Scorchy. B.
Nope, she's in The Ritz with Rita Moreno. As always, we end with the Henson Connection, or 6 Degrees in 60 Seconds, where we look at Kay Ballard's top four most well-known for on IMDb and see if we can get from those movies to Jim Henson in under a minute. Kay Ballard's top four most known for are Baby Geniuses, with Kathleen Turner, Christopher Lloyd, Peter McNichol, and Dom DeLuise. A 1957 TV movie of Cinderella with Julie Andrews and Edie Adams. Freaky Friday with Jodie Foster, Ruth Buzzi, and John Astin. And an insane 1990 This Doesn't Exist movie, which is either called Eternity or Evil Brother, depending on the video art, and which stars John Voight, Armand Assante, and Wilfred Brimley. So, can you get from those assorted cast members to Jim Henson in 60 seconds, starting now?
I need to change my 1.5 to 2.5, I believe, because Dom DeLuise to Jim Henson in The Muppet Show? Or not The Muppet Show, in The Muppet Movie?
That's correct. In just over 10 seconds, you remembered something from a previous episode.
Also, what I couldn't have done, since you mentioned also previous guest Ruth Buzzi, could I have gotten from Ruth Buzzi to her? No.
Well, you did Ruth Buzzi.
Oh, right.
When I was initially doing research for this, and we didn't know who was doing whom, I had gone from Freaky Friday to Jodie Foster.
Star Wars?
Nope. Jodie Foster to James Garner in Maverick. James Garner to his co-star in The Great Escape, James Coburn, who was in the Muppet movie.
Alternate for Kay Ballard was Frank Oz in the Ewok movie.
No.
He wasn't a voice in that?
No, he was not. I assumed you would have gone Kathleen Turner to any of the bazillion movies that she co-starred in with Danny DeVito, to Michelle Pfeiffer in Batman Returns.
And then
I don't remember what she's in, but she's in the thing with Jim Henson.
Michelle Pfeiffer is my touchstone.
That's right.
Yes.
That's how I figured you were. If you couldn't remember Dom DeLuise, that's how I figured you would have tried to go.
The only Kathleen Turner credit I can remember...
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Nope. Serial Mom.
Yeah, and I don't know anybody else who's in Serial Mom.
Neither do I. Never seen it. Just know I wanted to see it and was told I can't see it. I'm too young.
All right. Well, congratulations on 2 points.
2.5 points.
Doesn't count.
2.5.
So that stop trying to round up in order to try and cheat your way into parody.
Two of those answers were correct. Just one of them was slightly more correct. I still picked a correct answer.
No. So, now that we've established a little bit about Kay Ballard's career and her reputation, she was a Broadway and off-Broadway star, she was a powerful singer, she was a multi-instrumentalist, and she was a longtime sketch performer, let's look at her contributions to The Muppet Show through those lenses, where she first shows up in a musical number where she and Throg are dancing...
Thog.
Are dancing to a song called Oh Babe, What Would You Say?
Yes, oh baby, I know I could be so in love with you.
She's really giving it her all in her performance of being goofy and doing bits where she's pretending to be young and in love and playing up the comic contrast of the fact that she does not look like a young naive who is in love, and the person she's in love with also doesn't look like a young naive of anything.
Mm-hmm. The first time I watched it was another one of those Vincent Price, this feels like it's gone on for an interminable amount of time.
Mm.
Second time I watched it, it went a little bit faster, and also timing it made me realize it was only 2.88 minutes. So under 3.
But over 2.5.
But I appreciated what she did in the sketch. I thought Thog was great, because that's difficult to puppeteer and dance around like that in that monstrous thing. And sometimes that left arm was obviously just dead.
Flopping.
And sometimes it was articulating. So for Jerry Nelson,
Thog, the star of this episode.
Yeah, to be able to do all of that was incredible. So I like it for the performance while also being bored by it.
The trivia track wants to point out to you that in addition to all the other things that Jerry Nelson is doing with switching his arm between the arm and manipulating the face above him and peering out through the screen slightly underneath Thog's neck, he also has a television monitor strapped to his chest in order to see the performance, not just to be able to see out through the window.
Wow.
And while it's a small television monitor, it's a 1976 small television monitor. And part of the reason why Thog is so big is because you needed to have enough space for a television monitor in the barrel chest of that monster.
Which makes me wonder, because Kay hugs him and, like, gets pulled into him. Did she just headbutt him on him?
Well, her head is right at the level of the screen that Nelson's peering through.
So it probably hit her in the chest.
She sternum drove the monitor into herself, yes.
Yeah.
Can't have been the most comfortable experience, but she was very game.
Again, didn't really like it.
No, it.
But both performers do an excellent job.
The song has a moment in particular where it's building to this huge, grandiose moment, and the energy doesn't actually go along with the song. And I don't know if it's because the character is so big and the space is so big and empty that the energy gets lost.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a disconnect between what they're doing and how it reaches the audience. And I think that they were playing to a big empty room, and some of that saps the energy from the performance.
Yeah.
The next time Ballard shows up is in the Muppet Newsflash, where the Muppet Newsman is talking about how Miss Gretchen Powers of Boston is attempting to win the Guinness Book World Record for the longest sentence, and then proceeds to interview her while she's trying to continue to do the big sentence. Doesn't quite grasp the concept of she can't stop or he's going to ruin her record.
Although she's already been talking for 6 weeks, so she's probably broken that record already. So she could stop any time now and have that record.
Unless it's a sentence that she actually knows what the end is, and therefore is working towards an actual conclusion.
But from what we hear about it...
Because the final joke of this is...
That her husband has gone crazy?
Yes, and who says that the sentence, which the Muppet Newsman says doesn't make very much sense as he jumps in towards the end of it.
Or 6 weeks in. We don't know how much longer she goes.
Good point.
We could not even be at the halfway point.
Mrs. Powers' husband, Carl, said it makes about as much sense as anything she said.
But he says that from the clinging vine home for the crazed.
I thought, despite the misogyny of the final joke, that Kay did a really good job.
Mm.
I tried looking at her section to see if I could see her reading. You can't see anything in that tiny screen from 1976. I don't know, but I liked it. And the sentence made no sense, and I liked that too.
The talk spot begins with no real introduction, no greeting, but almost in motion, with Kermit talking about how he's having a little trouble with the band this episode, and Kay volunteering to try and talk with them because, as a musician, she knows how to talk with musicians.
So she calls Animal out.
And what Animal does is fairly different than anything we've seen Animal do before, where he basically speaks in long nonsense grunting noises, as opposed to the short actual vocabulary he's demonstrated in other things. Do you remember, did he do something similar to this in his introduction sketch, or did he actually just use short guttural sentences?
I don't remember. I feel like it was this. Like,
I think, but it was this, but short.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a paragraph of...
Yeah. But it makes sense for this to be that way, because he was having to explain himself versus, like, just answering a question or whatever it was.
And also, the bit here is that she speaks musician, and so therefore she could understand what to the audience is nonsense.
But Animal does then speak in the traditional Animal that we know
as well.
Yeah.
But we get our second of three performances of the theme, where Animal does a very dismissive...
Oh,
despite the fact that earlier, in a good bit, he, when Kermit says, "Don't you like the theme?" says yes, and then is told by Floyd, "No, he doesn't." So I'm not convinced that he's... I wasn't convinced prior to this that he actually didn't like the theme, that he was just a creature of gravity and influence. But here, he seems pretty convinced that the theme is bleh.
But then Kay fires back and says, "No, she likes it." And then she does her rendition, and
Kermit
dances,
joins in.
Yeah, to that.
That's when his critical commentary to her statement of support is to bite her on the shoulder.
Mm-hmm. Ben, is a bite a hit?
No.
Okay, I did not count it, but I have a bolded thing saying did not count bites as in the hit count. Need to add them if hits.
I anticipated that question because it's a very violent act.
Yeah. But it is not a hit.
Correct.
Yeah. I agree, but I wanted to make sure my statistics were correct, because they are true numbers, and numbers don't lie. 2.5 points.
You know what? I'm going to keep my own set of statistics. Every time you try to cheat on the numbers, you lose a point.
Every time you take a point away from me, I add 2 points.
Then the points are meaningless, and therefore you can't win.
Ben, whose line is it anyway?
The questions are all made up, but the points do matter.
So, she doesn't like that Animal bit her. So she says, you...
Grabs him by the neck and shoulders.
Yeah, and tells him...
Very intensely into his face.
That,
I'm just a guest here.
Discuss this with Kermit. So then Animal shouts disgust and then attacks Kermit.
Which is quintessential career-long Animal.
And then they proceed to cut back and forth between Animal attacking Kermit, and I have every single move that he did to Kermit.
Nice.
Documented.
And Kay reacting by covering her face, biting her hand, and genuinely being shocked by the violence that's occurring in front of her. Give us the list.
So he attacks Kermit with a bite, then he, Miss Piggy bites him, like, starts on stage and then jives off, like, underneath, behind the wall for a second bite. Then they both come up, and Kermit is in a triangle choke from Animal.
Are these official WWE terms?
These are jujitsu terms.
Oh!
Then after the triangle choke, they rise up again, and Animal has Kermit in an armbar. Then they disappear again. When they come up again, he has him in a sleeper hold. Then they disappear, and Animal returns with Kermit in a squished form.
Yeah, he's tied in a knot of his own limbs with his head sunken down into his chest. And Animal moseys off, apparently satisfied that he has discussed this. And Kay apologizes.
Is there anything else I can help you with?
How are you at notifying next of kin?
As she tries to pull his head back out of his torso and untie his arms.
Mm-hmm. It was good?
Yeah, I didn't necessarily think the K reaction shots worked in that, for whatever reason, they just didn't land with me as either over the top enough or realistic enough.
Yeah, but they...
But I say that only because in her final bit, she's so in tune with the absolute reality of the situation, this, in comparison, wasn't quite there. She's fine with Thog. She's doing a bit, but she's responding to him like a real creature. In the Piggy segment to come, she's superb.
Mm-hmm.
But in this, the cuts to her are not realistic acting or comic fake enough. They're sort of falling squarely in an unsuccessful middle.
Hmm. I felt like it at least showed that she had some genuine concern for what was happening.
They were supposed to.
I guess it worked for me.
But let's get to the final bit. She performs One Note Samba, which is absolutely one of my favorite bossa nova tunes, but I don't think I've ever, weirdly enough, heard it sung in English before. So she's singing the lyrics, and I finally understand that the basic lyrics are, if you're worried or nervous about performing, just try playing one note and see how it goes. And as she's done singing the first verse, Piggy has walked on stage, brushed her hair, and decided she's going to forcibly join in the performance and starts singing the second verse in an aggressive manner where, despite having not really appeared on the show before this, except at the dance and in the very opening where she clobbers Fozzie, she has taken Ballard's presence as an upstaging. This is what I anticipated from the Ethel Merman stuff,
mm-hmm.
but it's materializing here.
Yeah.
So their interaction is therefore very combative, and every time Piggy sings a verse or performs something, it's very much done at Kay. And then whenever Kay responds either with equanimity or pretending it's not really bothering her, Piggy goes off in a huff before coming back with a new escalation.
In one case, Kay gets violent. She pulls Piggy's hair.
Yes, but that's after Piggy has done several things, and Kay is starting to run out of patience. The hair pull happens before the final instrument act, which is brilliant, which is, I want to get to after we've done a catalog of all the other things. Piggy has a line where,
there's so many people who can talk, just enough, or nearly nothing. You have used up all the scale, you know, when at the end you come to nothing, or nearly nothing.
And she's very pointedly saying nothing at Ballard, as if she's the nothing in the song.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Kay is basically saying, I'm not dignifying this with a response. But when Ballard reaches to an instrument stand and pulls out a saxophone to play the one note of the One Note Samba along with the band, Piggy starts coming on from off stage with a variety of instruments to upstage her. First with a trumpet, then, and this is the first act of responding with aggression, Ballard does a brilliant thing where she switches from clarinet to saxophone and places the saxophone so it's on top of Piggy's head or in front of her, therefore upstaging her or downstaging her with the instrument so that she can't play, which Piggy shrugs off and then goes off to come back with a new series of instruments.
Mm-hmm.
The final instrument after a flute and a cowbell and a chime and a block is that Kay goes off and comes back with a tuba, which is loud enough to shock Piggy into silence, and then when Kay bows, the bell of the tuba goes down on top of Piggy, essentially muffling her.
Mm-hmm.
And that is such a fun, clever bit of choreography that I wasn't anticipating. The bow muffle snuff action is so much fun.
Yeah, I agree. And she does it twice. she bows again. Yeah, I liked this a lot. It was real fun.
Her energy is fantastic. It's very clear that she's playing the instruments, or if they are pre-recorded, that she knows how to. The flute is the only one that, to me, looked fake.
Yeah, the reason I guessed flute in the quiz was because she obviously, her lips were correct, but the fingering was off.
Correct.
So I knew she knew how to play the flute because she had the flute face.
Full disclosure... When I was rewatching this, the sound on my TV went out and I couldn't get it to come back on. So my second pass on the notes of this were based entirely on the subtitles. So I don't actually know what she was doing with the flute in that because I couldn't listen to it.
And as we've discussed, I have no musical talent at all, so...
All right, well, we'll edit some of that. But whether she was playing to a pre-recorded track, it seemed clear to me that she was moving air through the instruments in a way that this felt real to me.
Mm-hmm. I liked it a lot. It was lots of fun. I don't have much more to say.
I would just say I appreciated that song even more after knowing her history.
Mm.
And if Kermit had therefore done a Bruce Forsyth-esque introduction that talked about her as a multi-instrumentalist or as a comedic instrumentalist who previously played... I therefore would have been more excited for that song when it happened, and I would have brought my retroactive appreciation to probably the watching it the first time.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that wasn't done because they were widely known at the time, which does then make the Bruce Forsyth parts even more strange.
But it was also done for Candy Bergen.
Yeah.
So who they think needs context and who they think doesn't is very interesting and something that's very hard to retroactively interpret.
Right. Because, yeah, maybe at the time Kay Ballard was a household name. Well, according to your question, she never reached quite that level,
right,
but was at least familiar to people enough where they knew she did all these things.
I think they knew she was a singer. I think they knew she was a musical performer. I think probably a lot of people had forgotten if they ever knew that she... And I think that they're... Part of the reason for doing that was because it was a nice callback to her roots. It gave her an opportunity to do something that she was good at that might have been a surprise to people.
And then we have the outro.
Correct, which you wanted to get back to. So the outro begins, as I alluded to, with the band coming on to say, great, now we're finally done and we're out of here. Before Kay can even be thanked and introduced, they want to point out that they're done unless... Because they have demands. Floyd has a piece of paper. Unless they can get Ms. Ballard to sign this petition saying that they'll get rid of this theme song.
And Kermit shoos them away, so they're done.
And as Floyd says one more time, okay, we're anklin'. And he does his crazy R-crumb walk off the stage.
And then Kay enters and she says she loves all of the Muppets, except maybe Miss Piggy.
Who she claims as being very hoggy.
Which Piggy takes offense to because it's a pig pun, and she hi-yahs her with an elbow to the stomach.
I think this is the first time we've gotten a hi-yah to a human. I think all of Piggy's violence prior to this has only been to other Muppets.
Yeah.
So I thought that was very interesting. The trivia track points out that this is Karate Chop number 18 over the course of the series. Pete, do you think there will be any Karate Chops in Mum and Shaunts, the final production episode, or is 18 the total count for the episode? I will give you your half point back if you're right.
Ooh. I'm gonna go with heads, yes.
Okay.
I just flipped a coin in my brain.
The quarter of quandary has come up heads, and we will find out and finally settle our runner of this episode when we do Mum and Chaunce in a couple weeks.
Then, after Kay gets elbowed, Kay then chokes Piggy and slaps her four times before choking her again. At which point, Kermit says, "We'll see you next time on the Muppet Show. Goodbye." While more Muppets crash the stage, watching the
felt like
practice.
A smaller number of Muppets than we normally get, which is only appropriate
because so many just quit.
But also, those are Muppets that should have only been in the pit. And
sure.
It never occurred to me before to make sure that none of the Muppets crashing the stage at the end aren't in the pit. I wonder if we've ever seen any of the musicians in the crowd around the guest star before. I can't think of any, but it doesn't mean there aren't.
I feel like Dr. Teeth has been in one.
Something like that, yeah. So that's a big thing we've missed all this time, and I apologize. But it only really occurred to me because we get a fascinatingly different version of the end tune that is just Nigel conducting Rolf solo at the piano playing the theme song.
It sounds kind of player piano-esque.
Classic, slightly off-tune piano, and it's great.
It's really good.
It brings home just how good the Muppet Show theme is, and that Floyd is an idiot.
But instead of a Statler and Waldorf ending, Rolf tells Nigel that it does sound a little square.
Yes, Rolf disagrees with me. Nigel takes offense, and then we get the ding-ding-ding-ding. Well, let's continue on to statistics and rating. You've mentioned a repeated explosion. You've mentioned a number of hits. Let's see what else we've accomplished, and let's see what's accumulated.
There are 7 hits this episode, 1 explosion, as we already covered, and then in music, we're at 42.31%, which was 11 minutes and 13 seconds of music out of 26 minutes and 31 seconds of episode. The 42% is pretty in the middle.
Yeah, that's the number that I concentrate on as being standard.
Yeah. And as for ratings, we have another shift. So last week, I ranked Connie Stevens as 16.
Mm-hmm.
Connie Stevens has moved up. She's 15 now. Kay Ballard is 16.
Was there a 15 previously?
There was not. And I like them both about the same. And I feel like they're doing similar things, but Connie Stevens is just that scotch above.
I think it's kind of fascinating that the, by some accounts, second episode, and the, by definite accounts, second to last episode in Protection Number, are basically squarely in the middle and approximately the same in your eyes.
Again, this is guest star.
Yep.
I really enjoyed the thread of this episode. So I think this episode is more successful than the Connie Stevens episode. But what the guest stars are bringing to the episode, I feel, are on par of just right down the middle. It's good, and it's not bad.
I think I mentioned that I was pretty sure I hadn't seen this episode. That was definitely the case. I don't think I got through watching the entirety of the first season when I first bought it on DVD. I think I petered out sometime in the middle.
Rude.
And so, therefore, rude to you, not to Kay Ballard.
Yeah. No, that was all personal offense, rude. Do so I say rude every time someone says petered out? Yes, absolutely. It is one of my vocal tics.
Nice tick.
Thank you. Do I have to count that?
No. Wasn't in the episode, it was in our episode.
Oh, but what's the difference? They're both episodes. Is Matt LeBlanc here?
So I found this episode to be a fun surprise in a number of places. And I think that's going to be the heart of my moments. But why don't you start with your first of 5?
Before we get to moments,
yeah.
Should we make another wager? Will the theme song be back next week?
No, we shouldn't make that
wager.
Yeah,
no, because obviously
it's definitely going to
come back. I know. But it was on my mind of like, the band quits. They'll be back next week.
The trivia track points out that this is the only variation in the theme song in this season. There are variations in future seasons. So I unfortunately have had it spoiled for me as to what the result of that wager would have been.
So next week we won't get Floyd's Fugue for Frog as the opening credits?
We will not.
Bummer. Still 2.5 points then. So.
No. Depending on what happens in Mum and Chaunce, it's Schrodinger's half point.
I like that. So for my first moment, I'm going to talk about something that you briefly brought up, which is one of my favorite comedy tropes, which is someone saying, yeah, and then immediately saying no.
It is one of your favorite comedy tropes, which always blows my mind. However, we've talked about it before, so let's move on. When did that happen?
Animal.
Oh, of course.
Hey, Animal, you like the theme, don't you?
Yeah.
No.
Right, because somebody else changes his mind. That's why I didn't link it to the yeah, no bit, is because usually you like it when a person does it within the same thought.
Yeah, no, but this was close enough that it still struck that chord with me.
Moving barely along, I'm going to choose for the second moment when Animal does his version of the theme song. And I basically highlighted this when we were talking through that bit, but Animal's unintelligible garble that then turns into Frank Oz's flat, uninspired version of the theme song is surprisingly catchy and a lot of fun at how much he's working hard so that it's not a good version of the theme song. Frank consistently impresses with me with his comic chops. That's a fairly simple thing to have done, but it really made me laugh.
While we're giving Frank Oz praise, let's go back to talking about Piggy flailing around with her laughter. In that, the dance. I have it written that she basically 1-2-3 dips herself over and over again because of how she's jumping up and then falling down again as it fades to black. I laughed both times I watched the episode. It just surprised me the first time, and then the second time I just relished it.
Well, heck, let's make it an all five Frank Oz. I can't speak for what you're going to do for the fifth, but I'm going to say that in the folk trio bit, Frank's performance as the bass man is wonderful. I don't know, I might give Jim the edge of the way in which he does the vocalization of the banjo. But Frank's
that first time he does the scatting
is so strange and fun and funny. But Frank's guttural boings in the background is as a counterpoint to Henson's hyperactive tenor vocal banjo strumming. The two of them in conjunction is wonderful. That's what made me cackle both time I watched that, was just when they launch into that, I was in for it.
Well, this was a Jerry Nelson focused episode.
It was. So let's give him props for number five. Nope,
we're sticking with Frank.
Take it home.
George the Janitor, besides pogoing, which everyone should just assume is always in my top five moments.
It's your secret sixth or first moment?
Yeah, every time. But when he and Mildred are doing their bit, George laughs and then looks directly at camera and laughs for too long.
I just want to make you feel comfortable.
Between the pigs laughing and George laughing, that is definitely the fifth joke. Because it shouldn't go on that long, and he shouldn't be that pleased with himself. As we discussed, it's not a great joke. But he really likes the fact that he just put Mildred in her place by calling her
gutter.
Yeah.
Trash.
And I don't agree with that part of it, but his reaction to it is great. And classic Frank.
Well, it's a shutout, all the rest of the Muppet performers. Frank took all five, MVP of the episode.
This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is from archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cones' Yes, We Have No Bananas. Under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter, but no longer on Instagram, at farstnamebasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
There are things, dates, facts, names, a cappella instrumentations, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website and we will post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete. My co-host is Ben.
Da 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 da.
And we'll see you next time when we discuss production episode 24, guest starring Mum and Shans.
Yay! Okay, that makes much more sense. My note here was John Bottoms gets a credit for special Muppet dancing, but I dyslexed the words and I thought it said Muppet speed dating. And I couldn't remember why I would have written Muppet speed dating, but I was interested.